The Education Gadfly Show starts now.
Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my co-host, a man who shaved his head in empathy with Britney Spears, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mikey.
How you doing there, Rick?
I'm good, dude. This is crazy. You're not in the studio, as I'm sure the listeners can tell from your, like, your voice doesn't have its normal mellifluous tone. So I'm sitting there. They're making me sit in your chair, and I've realized how much in the corner we wedge you here in this little tiny kind of wedged-in chair, and your microphone's really low. You, my friend, are a little person.
Let's face it, Rick, I am a little person, and so it doesn't bother me so much. But you are right. I am not there in the studio. I am calling from beautiful downtown Columbus, Ohio.
Where are you in Columbus, Ohio?
I am in the Capitol Square Hyatt, overlooking the Capitol building.
Do they have a pool?
They do not have a pool.
Jacuzzi?
I don't think so, but, you know, maybe I should explore.
Yeah, dude. I got to say, if not, you got to get yourself a new travel coordinator.
That sounds good. Well, hey, what do you think about this Britney Spears thing? I mean, is this you're going to see, you know, teeny boppers all over the country shaving their head?
No, because she looks so skanky and nasty. You know, I mean, she could have played it for that. If she had kind of gone and she went and got the two tats right afterward, if she had gone out and got herself an attitude, but she just seems lost and now she's checked into rehab again and she looks gross. And she, like, wore a wig the next day, that puffy blonde. Like, she is just one. You know the person who's happiest in all of this?
What's that?
Justin Timberlake, baby. He is he is like, man, I am glad I got out from under that crazy skank.
Absolutely. What and, you know, Lindsay Lohan somehow, she makes pulling off going into rehab look more fashionable.
Well, she's got all her hair, for starters. Right. What do you think of the whole Britain escapade?
I think it's a good look for her, and you know, and it just keeps us focused, keeps our mind off of the depressing things that are going on in the world today. We can talk about Britney's hair. And stuff.
Yeah, we could paint her head like a basketball. She went to the All-Star game.
Yeah, I once painted my head like a basketball, but that's another story
for another time.
Listeners, if you have something to tell us about a time that you painted your head like a basketball, shoot us a line at letters@edexcellence.net. We would love to hear from you. All right, Rick, well, let's get going. We're going to start with a game of Pardon the Gadfly. Then we'll have Michelle McLaughlin of the American Federation of Teachers on our interview. We're going to ask her about Steve Jobs, the head of Apple, who made some inflammatory comments about teachers' unions the other day. And finally, in-house weirdo Liam will impart some education news of the weird. This week, it is about scrotums.
Huh. So, AFT and scrotums, and all in 15 minutes.
All right, let's play.
So is it? Don't speak too quick, or you'll be talking about a squirtum jobs.
Let's play. Pardon the Gadfly.
Well, get a Jen, Steve Jobs, scrotums,
right.
Scrotum jobs.
Right. Jen, topic
dude,
one.
Dude, you should have seen the confusion that reigned in the studio.
Topic number one.
Moving on, topic one. Steve Jobs says that unionization and lifetime employment in K-12 education are off the charts crazy. Will this have an impact? Will union reps construct iPod bonfires and burn Jobs in effigy? Mike?
See, when we're both in the studio, I can throw something at Rick to indicate that he should go first. I can't do that from here. Look, I think it's pretty interesting. You know, almost exactly a year ago, Bill Gates declared the American high school obsolete, right? That got a lot of attention, a lot of movement on high school reform. I'm wondering if this comment by Steve Jobs is going to have a similar impact on the education debate. What do you think, Rick?
That's a nice question. I mean, it is crazy to hear a reputable business leader saying these things. You know, we've been complaining for years that as soon as business leaders step into the education space, they turn all mushy and want to talk about collaboration and standards and, you know, that they don't really have the stomach to say anything that's going to tick people off. But you had Lou Gerstner doing this for a couple of years. And for Jobs to come in and say this, I think it's pretty cool. Who knows if it'll have any impact, but, you know, good for him for saying it.
Of course, you know, and Apple has plenty of skin on the line. I mean, they sell lots of computers to schools. In fact, as soon as he made that statement, he was at a Texas Education Reform Conference, and he said, I bet we just lost a lot of business in this state.
Yeah, I mean, you got to figure that this was not a carefully calibrated with their sales department.
Right. No, I don't think So and Michael Dell, who was also there, was very careful not to join in the fun and kind of kept his mouth shut.
Yeah.
But, you know, but
well, and I got to say, as a guy who owns a fair chunk of Dell stock, you know, nicely played, Michael.
Yeah. Well, now, the other thing here is that, of course, Apple has created this image of being kind of messy, you know. Well, I'm out of time. But we'll see. We'll see if he's going to move opinion on the left.
Well, we should ask, we'll ask McLaughlin, the AFT, about the fact that when they're losing the hippy dippy set. What does that say about the job the AFT is doing on the PR front?
I like that. Okay, Jen, what's next?
All right. Recent research by psychologist Carol Dweck has found that praising the intelligence of youngsters often makes them less apt to take on challenges because they're so concerned with looking smart. Praising students for effort, though, will actually help them perform better. Rick, what can schools take away from this study?
First, I'm skeptical of anybody named Dweck. You know, I'm sure she had a difficult childhood, and I'm not sure how accurate her insights may be. Now, where do we get the study? I haven't actually seen the study. Where did this come from? Jen?
It was in a serious journal.
Was it? Have you read it?
No.
Okay. I mean, it actually sounds – I mean, it does sound – I mean, this is the kind of stuff that actually – this is, you know, a competently done study that – these are the kinds of insights that researchers could actually give the teachers that would help them understand what's going to help kids succeed. If it turns out that telling kids that they are smart is counterproductive and telling kids nice job for busting their hump, which makes all the sense in the world, then this is a case where we could actually get research in the field and figure out what's going to help different kids succeed in school.
You know, first of all, Rick, I want to say I really think you're doing – such a great job working hard on this podcast and everything else that you do. And I just think you deserve an A for effort.
Dude, that is so cleverly played. But.
No, I agree. I mean, this is really fascinating because, you know, especially you have so many parents out there, you know, especially middle-class parents who, you know, believe that what they should be doing is praising their child at every turn and telling them from day one how smart they are. And in fact, that can have some bad repercussions because the kids learn that, okay, it's good to be called smart, so I don't want to take any risks that are going to make me look stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And so they end up, you know, in the studies that she does, the kids who have been called smart end up taking fewer risks. They choose easier assignments and the like. And it's really counterproductive. So you're actually right. This is great information to give teachers and parents.
You know, what's crazy about it, of course, is this is a kind of research that we don't do much of. We're so caught up in doing these real narrowly circumscribed, you know, the math, the national math panel, for instance, that we don't think much about these kinds of useful pedagogical research projects. So hopefully we'll see more of this.
All right. Jen, next topic.
All right. A recent article in the Japan Times blasts that country's high-stakes national tests, for which students spend years preparing.
Hold on, I think the studio's on fire, Jen.
I think it might be. It's just a hot discussion, anyway.
Sizzle.
Failing the test.
I tell you,
what?
You've been doing an excellent job, working hard. Love that episode.
Mike, the research I think only applied to youngsters. We don't know how well this applies to folks over the age of 22. Yeah.
But, you know, our listeners often call us juveniles, so I think it applies.
Well, we should try the strategy with Checker. We should see if praising Checker's effort yields desirable results.
That's a great idea.
All right.
Okay, Jen.
I'll recap.
Put out the fire.
A recent article in the Japan Times blasts that country's high-stakes national tests, for which students spend years preparing. Failing the test is viewed by many as shameful, and it can adversely affect the lives of Japanese adolescents for years to come. Mike, should the U.S. forget about national tests?
Whoa. Now, this is not really about national tests here. Okay, now I know that Fordham sometimes is seen as having an obsession with the national testing idea, but this is really a question about high-stakes tests. It's about, you know, this idea that in Japan, how you do in this one test is going to determine your future. Now, I think there, you know, we do need to have some debate in the United States about what kind of high school graduation exams we should have. The recent Mark Tucker report, the Tough Choices or Tough Times report, called for a more rigorous, basically high school exit exam. But importantly, and in line with American tradition, they said, look, students should be able to take this as many times as they need to in order to pass. So it shouldn't be used as, you know, a life or death, sudden death experience. And by all means, it shouldn't be a sorting mechanism to determine who's a winner and who's a loser. So, Rick, what do you think? Is that the right way to go?
So, Mike, so now if we're going to have these insignificant, unimportant national tests, what's the value of them? I mean, isn't part of the sales pitch from those who are carrying the national testing banner that they will help our schools look more like the schools of Japan or Western Europe?
Well, right. I mean, yes, I agree that there should be national testing. And I would be fine with a national high school exit exam that basically, you know, if you passed it, it would mean you're ready to take college-level work in any college in the country. I think that would be wonderful. But the difference here is that, you know, that test, you should be able to take that test as many times as you need to pass it. The goal should be to get as many students as possible to that standard so that they can go on and succeed in higher education. In Japan, what happens is it's really just used as a sorting mechanism, and that's the problem.
But wouldn't it get used as a sorting mechanism inevitably in the U.S. too?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think if it's just a gateway to further education rather than a mechanism to decide, you know, who's going to get into the best schools, then I think you can avoid that problem.
I'm feeling
and it, you know, also by giving kids a chance to take the test over and over again if they need to, you know, then you don't penalize a student for having one bad day.
Okay. Okay. We'll let you, we'll leave the rest of that for another day.
Very nice. Well, that is it for Pardon the Gadfly. Now we turn to this week's interview, which Rick has pinch hit for me. He's going to go ahead and interview because I'm not there. I like that effort you're giving, Rick.
Well, I'm going to try to tear it up. Let's see how it goes.
All right, let's take a listen.
I'm here with Michelle McLaughlin, Associate Director of the Education Issues Department at the American Federation of Teachers and co-contributor to the – okay, Michelle, first important question here. Is this the NCLB log or the NCL blog?
NCL blog, I guess. NCL, I guess you have to say the B twice, NCLB blog.
Oh, but there's only one B in the title.
I know, yeah. It looks better, though, that way.
It does. It looks pretty styling. They showed it to me. I'm like, yeah, NCL blog. I like that.
Yeah,
all right.
Look weird with CBs.
Okay, I'm feeling you. So now Apple Inc. CEO Steve Jobs thinks you may be involved in the devil's work there as part of the Education Issues Department. As our listeners may be aware, Jobs was speaking at something or other in Austin earlier in the week, and he voiced his concerns about America's teachers' unions. Jobs said, "I believe that what is wrong with our schools in this nation is that they have become unionized in the worst possible way, and this unionization and lifetime employment of K-12 teachers is off the charts crazy." Apparently, this has engendered quite a buzz in the blogosphere. What's your reaction to Jobs' comments?
Well, I think it shows maybe that we need to do a better job getting the message out to the business community about all the positive things that unions do in schools. There are a lot of places we could point to, and in fact, our president, Ed McElroy, is planning on contacting Jobs to say, you know, come visit some schools with us. Places where there's really exciting things happening, where the union is working with the district to improve student achievement and make the schools better, and hopefully he'll accept our invitation.
So now, what do you think it is that Jobs is wrong about?
I think that it's more that he doesn't necessarily know that there are a lot of places in the country that there's union and district collaboration on things like how to improve student achievement, how to improve teaching, the teaching practice.
Sure, I mean, right, and obviously the AFT has played a role in some of that. But now, on the other hand, I mean, it is the case that it's exceedingly hard to terminate teachers in a lot of school districts. In those places that aren't kinds of collaborative districts you're talking about, is this a concern that you think is valid in some cases, or do you think otherwise?
I mean, since he was speaking so generally, it's hard to know, you know, where he was talking about, because, I mean, there's plenty of states, for example, that still don't have collective bargaining. I think maybe he doesn't understand, too, and this has come up recently with all the talk about giving principals more authority to remove or, you know, get rid of bad teachers, is that principals in most places already have that opportunity before teachers get tenure, and they just have to do their jobs. They have to take that part seriously, you know, help help identify and, if necessary, counsel people out of the profession. I mean, that's their responsibility, and in most places they do have the authority to do that.
Now, by counsel people out, I mean, is that a nice way of saying that you're cool with them firing these people, or do you mean something?
I think, you know, like any profession, people don't always know what it's really going to be like when they're doing it, you know, every day. And so part of what you're providing feedback to them on is, you know, improving their practice. And if they don't have what it takes, then helping them make the transition out of the profession.
All right. But some people, you know, like being in schools and suck at it. And are you okay with them just being crudely terminated and fired if they don't get the clue?
No, I mean, of course, you know, we're a union and, you know, everyone knows, like, hey, you're entitled to a lawyer if you were accused of something. It's the same concept when we talk about due process. And yes, that's part of why, you know, you pay your dues and you're a member, is because you want representation in those kind of situations. Because, you know, let's be honest, you know, there's politics in any profession, and sometimes there's politics that are driving what goes on with removing teachers or trying to remove teachers. But if it's really based on documented, you know, evidence of failure to, you know, do the job, then that's something that, you know, that's when the union and the district have to work together to find a way to, you know, for this person to move on.
Now, if a hippy-dippy kind of tech guy like Jobs is saying this stuff, does this suggest that y'all's PR department needs to get fired and y'all need to bring in some new help?
No, I mean, I think, you know, he's obviously a private sector guy. He probably doesn't know very much about how schools work. You know, that's why we want him to take the time and visit some of these public schools where really good things are happening. And he just may be someone who, based on his own experience, obviously is that competition is good in the private sector. And so he wants to sort of take those principles and maybe apply them directly into the public sector and maybe just doesn't understand enough about how schools work.
Sure.
But I think, you know, if given the opportunity, he'll see that, you know.
Sure. I'm feeling you. This is my Petrilli hat where one is always convinced. Well, hey, thanks so much for your time, Michelle. And
sure.
Any closing words of wisdom for Jobs' colleagues out there in the big dollar private sector on what you think would be more useful for them to focus on rather than this union question?
The same articles that were circulating about what Jobs had to say also cited Michael Dell, and he seemed to have a better take on what's going on in school. So maybe Jobs and Dell can have a little confab and talk about it.
So I see the AFT. You guys, any Macs in the building are about to go out the window, huh? A big order for Dell coming in.
We have mostly PCs, actually.
Yes. Okay. Well, I'm sure Dell will be happy to hear that. Cool. Wait. Well, thanks for being on, and we'll look forward to talking to you again.
So, what do you think, Rick? Did Michelle convince you on any of these points?
She did. In fact, you know, as soon as I get a chance, I'm going to go see what it takes if I can still get my AFT membership from my time in Louisiana. Or actually, I don't think AFT is down there in Louisiana, is it?
Well, I think they've.
I don't know. Well, I'm going to drive my. Well, you know, heck, we're two blocks from the NEA. You know, what's the difference, right? AFT, NEA, they're all teacher union types. I'm going to go over and give them some money.
Very good.
I like Michelle, man. I didn't know her before. She's nice.
I was a little upset that you didn't ask Michelle about it, that cheap shot she made of me a few weeks ago.
That's true.
I was too old to be at the Lucky Bar.
You face it, dude. You are getting old.
But Rick, if I'm too old for Lucky Bar, what does that mean about you?
I've come out the other side.
That's right. All right. It is time for everybody's favorite education news of the weird with our special correspondent, Liam Julian. Liam, what's weird this week?
Scrotum. That's a word which appeared in the children's book, The Higher Power of Lucky, a Newbery Award-winning tome that set off a firestorm of criticism from school librarians. Some of them have promised to ban the book from their school's shelves. An anti-censorship backlash has since taken place. Pat Scales, a former chairwoman of the Newbery Award Committee, said of the angry librarians, quote, "That's what censors do. They pick out words and to look at the total merit of the book," unquote. The offending word appears when a character says a rattlesnake bit his dog Roy on the scrotum. Quote, "Scrotum sounded to Lucky like something green that comes up when you have the flu and cough too much." It sounded medical and secret, but also important, unquote. The book's author, Susan Patrone, maybe Patron, is stunned by the objections. The word is just so delicious, she said. Rick, what's your favorite children's book?
Dude, I want to hang out with Susan Patrone. I dig her. I love so many children's books. The Mysterious Disappearance of Leon, I mean, Noel, was always stellar. But I mean, there's so many. A Phantom Tollbooth, I love deeply. The Chocolate War is stellar. But I think if you got to go one, it might be The Westing Game by Ellen Raskin. Mikey?
Wow, that was a very serious response there, Rick.
Dude, I dig children's literature. Plus, the librarians are always a lot of fun.
It's an intriguing argument here that the censors only picked out this one word, and it wasn't about the whole total merit of the book. You know, so that's interesting. So what if the whole book had been called Scrotum, for example? You know, would that then be okay to censor or ban or not?
Well, I mean, they had a lot of characters talking about how delicious scrotums are. I mean, I could see that giving real pause to an elementary library. But it doesn't even sound like she used delicious when talking about scrotum.
Right.
She
and
just
I think it's important,
tossed it in there.
It's important to know that it was actually a dog scrotum that was being discussed. Doesn't that make a difference?
Does that make it better or worse, though?
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
You know, in Amsterdam, they've got a lot of literature about, like, dog scrotums, and I'm not sure any of it's suitable for elementary classrooms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So would you have let your high school students read this book about scrotums?
Yeah, I would have. I remember when we read The Tao of Poo, I had a couple of parents who were deeply concerned about the yin-yang symbol on the cover. It gave them concerns due to their faith. But I thought it was important to read it, so we worked out an appropriate accommodation. So, you know, what can you say? And there wasn't a single scrotal mention in that whole volume.
Yeah. Well, Liam, thank you for bringing this important news of the weird to our attention.
You're welcome, Mike.
We're all a bit more formal long distance, aren't we?
Indeed.
Well, Michael, thank you for hosting. And Liam, thank you for your stellar
My
reporting.
Pleasure. It's my pleasure.
Liam, it must have been a lot of hard work to find this story about the scrotum and to write that brilliant and witty.
No. You don't want to compliment the wittiness of it for trying to be witty.
It was just hard work.
Yeah. And trying to be witty.
That's right. Way to work hard, bro. All right. Well, you listeners have worked hard because you've made it to the end of this podcast. That's all the time we have for this week. Thanks for joining us. Don't forget to read the original Education Gadfly at www.edexcellence.net. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation. Signing off.